This podcast contains explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. The following program presents an examination of a criminal investigation. Any individual who may have been investigated or faces criminal charges continues to be considered innocent until proven guilty.
911, what's your emergency? My granddaughter has been taken. She has been missing for a month.
Her head is bleeding severely. We need an ambulance.
This is Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. I'm Marcia Clark.
You don't know what my involvement is in stuff?
And that's Casey Anthony, mother of the toddler, Kaylee Anthony, and the defendant in the notorious case, Florida versus Casey Anthony. The Anthony case divided the country. Some people were happy with the verdict, others were not. In my TV show on A&E, Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, we investigated the case and turned up shocking new evidence. I mean, evidence that really blew my mind. But there were aspects of the case we didn't cover, intriguing layers that were actually better explored in conversation on a podcast. And then I realized that was true for all the cases we investigated on the TV show. And so, in this podcast, we're going to explore the fascinating angles we didn't have time to cover in the television show. This show, we're going to get into the psyche and what made the jury decide to acquit Casey Anthony. So let's get into the case. So we all get on the same page. I'm going to give you an overview of the evidence. Let's go back to 2008. Then, 22-year-old Casey and her daughter were living with Casey's parents, George and Cindy Anthony, in their Orlando home. On June 16th, George saw his daughter and granddaughter leaving the house. Casey claimed she was going on a mini vacation in Jacksonville. That day in June was the last time Kaylee was seen alive. 2 weeks later, it was the 30th. Cindy and George received a call from a towing company. The family car had been found abandoned in front of a cash advance business and towed away. The Anthonys were worried because Casey had been using the car for her trip, for that mini vacation. Cindy called around to Casey's friends and eventually found out that Casey'd been staying with a boyfriend in Orlando the entire time. When she confronted Casey, Casey claimed that Kaylee had gone missing and that she'd been looking into her daughter's disappearance herself. It had been a whole month, and this was the first time anyone heard that the child was missing. Cindy made a frantic 911 call to report her disappearance.
911, what's your emergency?
I found out my granddaughter has been taken. She has been missing for a month. Her mother finally admitted that she's been missing.
Okay, what
we're talking about a three-year-old little girl.
Oh, God, she's three. George
Kane is missing.
Okay, I understand. Can you calm down for me for just a minute?
The next day, sheriff's deputies asked Casey where her daughter was. Casey said she'd been working at Universal Studios and that she'd been leaving Kaylee with a nanny named Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez. Casey said that when she'd gone to pick Kaylee up, both the nanny and her daughter were gone. But the thing is, Casey's story didn't add up. For one thing, the nanny didn't exist. And the apartment where Casey claimed she dropped Kaylee off had been vacant for months. The police arrested Casey, and they charged her with child neglect. In the arrest affidavit, police specifically made a note that Casey showed no obvious emotion about Kaylee's disappearance. Okay, let's stop for a minute. Casey, Kaylee, and then there's Cindy. I mean, it's crazy. So instead of saying Kaylee, I'm going to say the child, the toddler, the daughter. You get the drift. Anyway, shortly after Casey's arrest, anonymously posted pictures popped up all over the internet showing Casey partying during the past month while her child was missing. Police found a strange poem Casey'd written on her MySpace page shortly after her daughter disappeared. It included the lines, "What is given can be taken away. Everyone lies, everyone dies. Life will never be easy." Thank you. At Casey's bail hearing, detectives said they'd found hair that could have been Kaylee's, that is, Casey's daughter, in the trunk of Casey's car. At this point, Casey was officially a person of interest in her daughter's disappearance, and the police announced they were treating that disappearance as a potential homicide. People continued to search for the child, and the media focus mounted. Just to give you some idea, at one point, reality star bounty hunter Leonard Padilla traveled to Florida from California, and he claimed Casey had reached out to him and promised that if he got her out of jail, she'd help him find her daughter. So he posted Casey's bond, and then he tried to persuade Casey to tell him exactly what happened to the child, but he didn't get anywhere with her. Later, he told the press he was convinced that the child was absolutely not alive. And he said he was struck by Casey's lack of emotions and her flat affect, which is exactly what the investigators who questioned her back in July had noted as well. 3 months later, although police still hadn't found the child's body, they filed charges of first-degree murder, aggravated child abuse, and aggravated manslaughter, as well as 4 counts of lying to the police, and a Florida grand jury returned an indictment on all charges. What that means is that a grand jury decided that there was enough evidence to take Casey to trial on all of those charges. The FBI released lab reports, finding that a strand of hair found in Casey's car was, quote, microscopically similar to her child's hair, and that it showed signs of decomposition. That would mean that the child's body had been in the trunk of the car. But they couldn't conclusively determine that the hair really did belong to the child. They also had air sample reports from the trunk that showed chemicals that were consistent with human decomposition as well as chloroform residue. But I want to turn away from the physical evidence for a moment and talk about Casey's strange behavior. As I mentioned before, the police were struck by the fact that Casey showed no obvious emotion. And then, Padilla, the bounty hunter, said the same thing. A potential juror even said that she thought Casey was a narcissist. And then armchair psychologists all around the country weighed in with their labels, psychopath, sociopath. But what do all those labels really mean? What's the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath and a narcissist? Now, I'm not an expert on this area, but I know someone who is. So I called on my friend, Dr. Bethany Marshall, who's a psychoanalyst. Let's get into this. Psychopath, sociopath, they don't seem to know the difference. They use them interchangeably. They're not the same thing.
Not at all. So at the mild end, you have the narcissist who is unempathetic, not very remorseful, has low levels of engagement. When you get to the sociopath, all these traits are intensified. The clear differentiation between sociopath and psychopath is the addition of cruelty. So a sociopath might kill their child, but they're not going to torture the child.
I want you to listen to some of these tapes of her conversations when she's in custody. To me, the most illuminating is when she's talking to her mother and a couple of her friends and her brother. She's only been in custody a short time.
Hello, Casey?
Mom, I just saw your cameo on TV. You don't know what my involvement is in stuff?
Casey.
Mom.
You're not telling me where she's at.
Because I don't know where she's at. Do me a favor, just tell me what Tony's number is. I don't want to talk to you right now. Well? Can you get Tony's number for me?
And here's the problem with Casey's elaborate web of lies. It's hard to imagine anybody should believe a thing she says. And the only member of the family who really did seem to be in denial, at least to me, was Cindy. During my investigation for the television show, I talked to one of the witnesses. He didn't want to come forward, but he knew the family, and he told me something that really struck me. He said, I saw Cindy and I saw Casey, and they came walking into the house, and it was really clear to me that Casey was pregnant. And I went to Cindy and I said, so when is your daughter due? And Cindy said, what are you talking about? Casey's not pregnant. I mean, let me tell you something. Casey's a very petite woman. She's small. This is not somebody who could hide a pregnancy. And at that time, She was at least 4 months pregnant.
So what happened is the mother goes and seeks psychotherapy for herself. This female therapist advises Cindy to tell Casey, like, tough love, tell your daughter she's got to take care of the granddaughter, or you're not going to support Casey anymore. I kind of feel sorry for the therapist that gave this advice. It really backfired. And it was very, very soon after that that Kaylee disappeared.
Yeah. Do we know what motivated Cindy to go and seek psychotherapy?
She had quite a few marital problems. And can you imagine, you're in a marriage, you have your own marital problems. It must have been a pressure cooker in that household. My heart goes out to Cindy in some ways because I think that she was determined to think the best of Casey. She had the blinders on, and boy, those blinders were thick. But it wasn't until the car was found at the tow yard, remember, and the tow yard operator and George smelled like a decomposing body. And it seems to me that that was the dawning of consciousness for Cindy.
I found my daughter's car today, and it smells like there's been a dead body in the damn car.
Okay, what is the three-year-old's name?
Kaylee, C-A-Y-L-E-E, Anthony.
You know, she makes that statement, and she later backed away. I didn't know what I was smelling. I really didn't. It probably was garbage. It was just rotting
pizza.
Garbage. Pizza.
Pizza.
Unbelievable. And if you've ever smelled decomposing body, which I have, you don't mistake that for anything else.
It's not pepperoni.
No, it's not pepperoni. 6 months later, there's a big development in the case. More on that after the break. Are you hiring? Posting your position to job sites and waiting and waiting and waiting for the right people to see it? Well, ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies the people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just 1 day. That's fast. 1 day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you never miss a great match, which is very helpful, you know? The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right. I said it. Free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/MCI. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MCI. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we're back with Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. At this point, the child had been missing for 6 months, and the police had charged Casey with murder, but they still hadn't found a body. That finally happened on December 11th, when partial remains, bones, and a skull with some hair that was attached to duct tape, I'll get back to that later, were found in the woods about half a mile from the Anthony home. And let me tell you something. I drove from the Anthony home to the place where her remains were found. It's like 2 minutes, maybe 5 minutes walking, just around the corner. Anyway, it took a few days for the DNA results to come back, but ultimately, the testing confirmed that the remains belonged to Kaylee Anthony, Casey's daughter. Casey's trial, which took place in 2011, quickly became a national obsession. The entire situation was horrifying for many, but also oddly fascinating. And the Casey Anthony trial was actually the first big murder trial of the modern social media age. I think that had something to do with how it became such a huge obsession. People could talk to each other about the case, about the mother, about the child, through social media. In fact, ironically, one of the first public mentions of the case was a MySpace post by Cindy Anthony, Casey's mother. She wrote that Casey stole money from her and wasn't letting her see her granddaughter. The case was also live streamed. There were video feeds and wall-to-wall coverage on multiple cable news channels. Newspapers, including the Washington Post and the Miami Herald, streamed the proceedings on their websites. I mean, you couldn't get away from the case. And on the ground, there was a broadcast village of sorts with hundreds of media trucks parked near the courthouse. Across the street, a two-story air-conditioned building went up just to house the journalists. Everyone in the public seemed to have their own take on this case, what they thought of Casey, who they thought did it, how they thought it happened, and they all took to social media to give their theories.
She was definitely in that trunk. So tragic and sad. Hashtag Casey Anthony belongs in jail.
Waiting for world peace is like waiting for Casey Anthony to reveal what happened to Kaylee Anthony.
On your reaction video, were you with Zanny the nanny? Hashtag Casey Anthony.
I don't know whether it's true or not, but I heard that Jose Baez, the defense attorney for Casey Anthony, had people scanning the social media, relating to him all the comments and observations people were making about the case, and that he based his entire trial strategy on what people were posting on social media. So I decided to reach out to one of the jury consultants who worked on the case, Richard Gabriel. So, in the defense of Casey Anthony, what kind of juror were you looking for?
Well, first and foremost, as you well know, the pretrial publicity in the case was so pervasive, so comprehensive, and so vehement that we had strong concerns that even though people uttered those magic words, I can set it aside, when the evidence actually came in, those stories would come flooding back into their minds, and they would still think, how could she have done this? She's guilty.
So the real question then was motive. Why would Casey kill her child? The prosecution argued that Casey did it because she wanted a carefree, child-free life. And her former boyfriend told police that not long before the child disappeared, he told Casey that he never would have dated her if he'd known she had a child. I think he felt guilty about that, and I think that's probably why we don't hear from him anymore. He did testify at the trial, though. How was the child killed? Prosecution believed that Casey drugged her child with chloroform and then put duct tape over her nose and mouth and then suffocated her to death. Although there was no more flesh left, the position of that duct tape when it was found showed that it would have been over Kaylee's nose and mouth. The prosecution also believed that Casey kept her body in the trunk of the car. And then, for 31 days, she lied to her parents and the police about what had happened to her daughter. So the biggest problem for the state was really a lack of physical evidence. For months, Kaylee's body lay in a plastic bag in the woods. In fact, searchers that went all over the area, they walked right past the child's body because it was under 4 feet of water. So by the time her remains were found, there were no fingerprints on the duct tape. No eyewitnesses had seen Casey hurting her child. In fact, the photographs and videos of Casey with her daughter looked loving, even devoted. Most of the proof hinged on the abandoned car that Cindy said smelled like a corpse during her 911 call. When Casey's father, George, took the stand, he also said the car smelled like a corpse. Now, George is a former cop, and based on his experience, he said the scent of a decomposing body is something, quote, you never forget, end quote. And a prosecution expert testified that the smell was certainly produced by a corpse, not garbage. So here's what the defense said. They claimed that the child had drowned in the Anthony family pool, that it was an accident. But that Casey was afraid to come forward because she was terrified of her father, George. And she claimed that he'd been molesting her from the time she was 8 years old. The molestation claims were shocking, in part because nobody had brought them up before. And Casey's defense team never offered any real evidence to support the claim. For his part, George denied the accusations. He said it really hurt him to be accused like that. I'm sure it did.
You know, towards the end, she expands the story to say that she was afraid that Kaylee was going to be molested by George. And she would never let Kaylee be in front of George without a diaper. So she really throws her father under the bus.
And the problem with this case also is that so much of it had been in the media for years. And so when the prosecution put on its case, it didn't have a lot of impact.
Yeah.
When the defense brought in the concept of maybe she was abused by her father and there was a strange dynamic and maybe she drowned, and all of a sudden that's new information for the jurors.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed more salient. It seemed maybe more relevant to them, and it maybe had more of an impact.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, I mean, I 100% agree with you, and it almost gave it more credibility because it was new. Even though no evidence was ever presented to support it, that bell could not be unrung.
And so the defense played right into that. The defense set it up this way, that Casey was the victim of this horrible father who'd been molesting her for years, and that when the baby fell in the pool and drowned, he threatened Casey, and he was the one who said, "We have to hide the body. We don't report it," who prevented Casey from going to the police. That, in a nutshell, is how the defense set it up to look like Casey was the victim. More on that after the break. You know, boyfriends and husbands, they come and go. But a mattress is forever, especially if it's a great one. Casper's a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. Casper products are cleverly designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies, even mine. Now, you spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you really should be comfortable. I wish I got one-third anyway. Casper has a breathable design that helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. And if you're like me, and for some reason your body gets hot at night, which is ridiculous, you really need a mattress like this one. Casper also offers a wide array of other products, like pillows and sheets, to ensure an overall better sleep experience. And guess what? All these products are designed and developed and assembled in the good old US of A. And they have affordable prices because Casper cuts out the middleman and sells directly to you. Not only that, but they have hassle-free returns if you're not completely satisfied. In fact, you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. You can get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/MCI48 and using promo code MCI48 at checkout. Of course, terms and conditions apply. And we're back. The prosecution countered the defense's drowning story by focusing on Casey's behavior in the days following her daughter's death. For one, tattoo artist Bobby Williams testified that about 2 weeks after the child disappeared, Casey came to his shop to get a new tattoo. It said Bella Vita, which is Italian for beautiful life. Williams said Casey was happy and chatty in his shop. She was talking to her friends on her cell phone. Definitely not what you'd expect to see for any mother, even if her child had died accidentally. So in order to overcome that obstacle, the defense called a grief expert, Dr. William Weitz. He testified that young people like Casey, who was 22 at the time her daughter died, display their emotions abnormally when they're grieving. That Casey was engaging in magical thinking to convince herself that something else had happened. It was a form of denial. But if Casey was in denial, how does that explain this text message to a boyfriend? Quote, "I'm the dumbest person and the worst mother. I honestly hate myself," end quote. That doesn't sound like someone who's in denial. As for the dysfunctional family dynamic and alleged molestation, recordings of Casey talking to George while she was in jail show her telling him, "You've been a great dad and the best grandfather." But what does all that mean? Dr. Bethany Marshall has a great deal of experience on this case in particular.
So Dr. Weitz makes this fascinating conclusion, I think, that I don't agree with, that the reason she seems so intact and she never mutilated or had eating disorders is that she's just really well defended. She has a good set of defense mechanisms. And the attorneys, rightly so, keep questioning Dr. Weitz about that because it just doesn't fit any clinical syndrome that I know of as a psychoanalyst or even the layperson knows.
Yeah, that you in your experience.
Never. A person's never asymptomatic after an experience like that. I think the general public, if somebody says, "I was molested as a child," they cannot imagine that somebody would make that up because what we're told is that sexual abuse victims are not believed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So if Casey's a sexual abuse victim and it drove this terrible event in her life, who am I as the juror to not believe her? Am I going to be one more callous person in society that doesn't protect our victims? I mean, I think it tapped into that sentiment too.
But here's the thing. When it comes to molestation, you just never know. I can't say whether it's true or false that Casey was molested. And just the fact that she didn't report doesn't mean it didn't happen. The crux of the issue, whether or not she was molested, is, did Dr. Weitz adequately explain the reasons for Casey's bizarre behavior after her daughter died? Because the behavior looks like someone who's celebrating, not someone who's in denial. Let's get back to the physical evidence. The medical examiner, Dr. Jan Garavaglia, couldn't say exactly how the child was killed, but she completely ruled out drowning, saying she was, quote, confident, end quote, that the child was murdered. And she testified, and here's the quote, 100% of the time when a person finds a drowned child, they call 911. That's what she said, 100% of the time. And you know, I don't know if you can say anything is 100% true 100% of the time, but doesn't that just make sense? Because why would a young mother and a former cop cover up an accidental death? And why would they do such a sloppy job? And one of the things that struck me is George, a former cop. Would he really dump a body just around the corner from his house and not even bother to bury it? I mean, it just makes no sense. And Dr. Garavalli also pointed out the fact that the body was in a plastic bag was another red flag. And then, of course, as I've said before, there was the duct tape. The state showed the jurors a video of how the child would have suffocated with that duct tape placed over her nose and mouth. All of this should have posed an insurmountable obstacle for the defense. But you know, there was an even simpler and in some ways bigger obstacle for the defense theory of accidental drowning. And that's Casey's own behavior. So remember I talked about the FBI's finding that there was evidence of chloroform in the trunk of the car that Casey had been driving. The defense had a theory that Casey gave her child chloroform to help her go to sleep. I don't know how that could possibly be true. First of all, I don't even know how to get chloroform. So, you know, I mean, there's also a lullaby or rocking a child. But if you're going to use a drug, chloroform? Seriously? I mean, even if your daughter died accidentally, partying, hanging out with your boyfriend, the hot body contest, getting that tattoo, all during 31 days while her child was missing, or as she later claimed, accidentally drowned. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the mentality of the jury. It seemed to me that the jurors, they refused to accept the prosecution's theory that this was just a situation, as you've said, where she wanted to have a carefree life, like the tattoo she got during the 30 days yes. Haley was missing, La Bella Vita.
La Bella Vita.
She was having it. So it feels to me like something else is going on with the jury here, and it's like an unwillingness to believe that Casey did it.
It is harder for a jury to look across the courtroom and see a young woman and say, I am willing to put her to death. Jurors thought there should have been DNA evidence. And of course, there was no DNA evidence.
You know, and, Richard, that's what they call the CSI effect.
As you know, in this particular case, it would be ridiculous to expect DNA evidence.
Right. So Kaylee's remains were in that wooded area for months and months. And during that time, there was enormous heat. Remember, we're talking about Florida. And then torrential rains. And the rains flooded the area so much that at one point, her remains would have been under 4 feet of water. The searchers walked right by it because there was no way to search in all that water. You're going to get so much decomposition that virtually all DNA evidence that might have been able to show who put the duct tape on her body is gone. That kind of evidence got washed away.
And they want to understand what happened here. And when it came down to really what was the story that made the most sense, they just felt that this bizarre accident where Kaylee wandered out in the backyard and fell in the pool was a much more plausible story.
I mean, the notion about a drowning, it really confuses me. Because when a baby drowns, you call 911. And yet, they bought it.
You know, and I hate to keep coming back to this, but motive is so important to jurors. They want to know what happened here.
Motive. That was an issue for the prosecution. They just didn't believe after they saw these devoted pictures. I mean, photographs and videos showing Casey with her daughter, and they looked very loving. Now, the truth is, legally speaking, prosecution never needs to prove motive. In fact, there's a jury instruction that says motive is not an element. Because at the end of the day, how does a person ever prove someone's motive? That's inside their head. But that doesn't mean the jury doesn't want it anyway. And I have yet to ever handle a case in which the jury didn't demand an explanation, because actually, regardless of what the law says, juries want to know.
And I just don't think they had enough from the prosecution to say, here's why.
Ultimately, after seeing 400 pieces of evidence and hearing testimony from dozens of witnesses and experts, the jury of 7 women and 5 men acquitted Casey, not just of murder, but also of child abuse. They only convicted her of lying to the police. So she was released with credit for time served. Basically, walked right out the door.
Ultimately, the mystery is in this case, and that's where everybody kind of still, I think to this day, doesn't know what happened here.
I mean, I think some of us feel that we do.
I investigated the Casey Anthony case on my TV show, Marcia Clark Investigates, The First 48. And in it, I uncovered evidence that was never presented at trial. I mean, evidence that really blew my mind, and I think might really have changed the verdict. Tune in and watch March 29th at 9 p.m. on A&E. And I invite you to call in and ask questions. I've set up a hotline. Just call 402-882-6474. That's 4028 VANISH. V as in Victor, A-N-I-S-H. Email us at MarciaClarkPodcast@aenetworks.com. I'll answer your questions on the next episode of this podcast.
Marcia Clark Investigates The First 48, the podcast. Hosted by Marcia Clark. Produced by Emil Klein and Chelsea Great. Researched by Robin Kiyomi. Supervising producer is Scott Brody. Executive producers are Marcia Clark, Ted Butler, and Peter Tarshis. Music is by Blake Maples.
With special thanks to our location scout, Rob Wood.
We're distributed by Audioboom. The TV series Marcia Clark Investigates The First 48 is produced by ITV and airs at 9 p.m. Thursdays on A&E. Find out more at aetv.com.